Hello, this is Down the Back of the Seats. I'm Ellen, Cinema Manager at Campbelltown Picture House.
And I'm Alistair, film and theatre maker based on the Isle of Mull.
Alistair, what is this podcast about?
This podcast explores what happens when the public and public spaces meet. What is left behind? What's been found that's unexpected? What stories are there to tell? It's tales from behind the scenes at the cinema, theatre, concert hall, wherever people meet, linger, and leave things or bits.
Excellent. We have got another person to talk to this week.
Which is fab.
This is Michael Terrio, who is an actor. He's done lots of film, theatre, a lot of musicals. He's a musical guy, singer, dancer. He's a brilliant dancer. And he is also in a lot of films, a lot of horror films, as it turns out, which we talk about with him. He's in Cult of Chucky, the most recent Chucky film. And he's also in the series of Chucky as different characters, recurring different characters. His stage work, I guess the most notable ones are Lord of the Rings. He played Gollum / Smeagol in Lord of the Rings. That was in Toronto and the West End and in The Producers on Broadway. And then heaps and heaps of other stuff, including the Shaw Festival and Stratford Festival in Canada. And he's just about to go back into Shaw in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe and Anything Goes, which I'm going to go over and see.
I'm very, very jealous. That'd be really cool.
Yeah, it's great. I first saw him, I think, at Shaw Festival in two plays he was doing there. One was Rope, which he was excellent in that. And then Brigadoon.
Oh,
they
God.
Did a production of Brigadoon.
Oh, Jesus. Let's not talk about that.
Yeah, which he was also very good in. Then there were some. I didn't mention this to him because I thought he might ask me about the accents. And then I'd have had to go,
they were interesting.
They were good.
Yes.
They actually, do you know what? They actually weren't too bad. It was the main girl. She's got a beautiful voice and she's a wonderful actor. But she struggled.
Okay.
With the accent. And then everybody else's accents were sort of okay. But they were all from very different areas of Scotland.
Not one mythical town. Well, without further ado, let's meet the lovely Michael Terrio.
I want to start by asking you about audiences. Alistair and I spend a lot of time talking about audiences, how they've changed, how they behave. What's your relationship with an audience? Are they friend or foe?
I usually have to kind of pretend they're not there.
Right.
I often don't have a lot of courage to actually look like if I've done like a something where you're directly addressing the audience, I'm usually looking at that place above their heads and pretending I'm seeing their faces. That said, I take a long break from theater and I just went back and did a show at here in Toronto at Young People's Theater, which is really like mostly for school groups. And they put all the little people, like the five-year-olds at the front, the high schoolers at the back, like it's about 450 seats. But so the people that you see on stage are these little five-year-olds. And that was the most freeing thing because I actually, like, you try to ignore them and they're like, you know, to see you. And so I said, I'm just going to look at you. And it was awesome. I thought, if I can just imagine that who I'm seeing is those people instead of the judgy, you know, the judgy audience members. You're like, I remember doing The Producers and, you know, I was out on stage with a line of dancing girls and crazy lights and everything and looking at the front row and people just like this. And I thought, what more do you want? You know? So it was very rewarding.
Right. Yeah, that was Willy Wonka that you just did, and you're about to go into The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe also for families and children. Are kids a challenging audience, or is it kind of better?
It was better, yeah. And that theater particularly makes a point of not telling kids how to behave. So they let kids make noise and respond in whatever way they want to respond. And I actually got to the point where on the weekends we do like four shows for families, and I Didn't like them as much, even though the adults were laughing at the adult jokes that went over the
Yeah.
kids, because there's a lot of adult jokes in that show. It's written really for not
Family.
yeah, for family. But the kids were so sort of suppressed in their reactions. It was a real letdown. Like, I'd rather them wrestling and
Yeah.
gasping or making noise because they're really engaged.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the shows I directed, we took across the world. We got taken to Hangzhou in China. I think it was Hangzhou. And it's a kind of a city where there's more billionaires than anywhere else. It's an insane place. And we were sitting in we were in a dance studio that we converted into a theatre, and there was immigrant children from the north of China that were there. And they were not looked upon positively by the Chinese state. They were kind of people that were on the outside and on the edges. They're thought of as kind of more wild people. And these kids were feral. It was wonderful. They were kind of and really, really engaging with the show because they'd never seen anything like it before, but were like treating it like someone was talking directly to them. And there in the middle of the audience was an old monk as well, an old Buddhist monk. And he just sat smiling all the way through it, and my friend Ailey, who was on stage, directed the performance directly to him, and it was just this. It was it without a shadow of a doubt. It was the best show I've ever been involved in. It was just wonderful, and it was the kids owned it, the monk owned it, and the performer owned it. And it was like, this is perfect exchange of moments together. It was lovely.
Yeah, I mean, that is what makes theater great, is it's like a such a communal experience. And you when you kind of feel that heightened, it's fantastic.
When you were working with Lord of the Rings, I'm a big fan of Lord of the Rings. My son is a particularly massive fan. You developed the show in Canada and then took it to the West End. It was taken to the West End.
Yeah.
How was that, being part of a show where the audience are so invested in the property as such? How did that feel between the relationship between yourself on stage and the audience? Was there a kind of sense of, was it different in some ways?
Not really. I mean, sometimes there are people like if you're looking at the conductors, because the whole show was underscored. Like there were, it wasn't, it was a musical kind of, it was a play with music. It was kind of its own thing. And
Yeah.
the entire show was underscored by like a 55 piece orchestra. It was huge. And so often you'd be backstage and be looking up at the conductor on the monitor. And you'd see occasionally there are people. That's the only time I had the courage to look at anybody. But I'd see people like with ears, like elf ears, and like in costume
Oh.
behind him, you know.
How
And
lovely.
so that was, you know, the only time I really encountered anything different than a regular audience. It always still felt like a regular audience. And I would say just to comment on what you're saying, the show was actually, it was a British entity. Like the producers and the director and the creative team was all from London, and they came to Toronto to develop it and to try it out here,
Wow.
and then brought it back, reworked it and changed a lot, and opened it again in London. And the cast in the cast in London were all London actors, except for me, really. And
Wow.
me and another actress who was in the company, Alexis Bonnet. So not Alexis, Alexandra. Sorry, names. But I know, I haven't seen her in a few years, but Alexandra Bonnet, incredible singer. But she's also Parisian, so she could be in the company. But yeah, so that's so it was a different show altogether with a different cast.
Am I right in remembering that there was an accident quite early in the run with the tower that built it? What happened there as well, and what was the kind of fallout from that?
So I forget the actor's name, but what had happened is the set was 18 elevators that were ice-shaped in three concentric circles, so they could all
Wow.
evolve and grow and shrink. And
Ah, oh, lovely.
but the way they had built that is underneath each, so if this is the pie, this
Yeah.
part was a safety mechanism. So if you touched it, like as at the bottom, this is the elevated piece, the elevator would lock. So what they didn't know was that in the corners, that wasn't protected. So what happened was an understudy, the swing went on, and he stepped back into that hole, but the elevator, the mechanism didn't recognize anything was there, so kept going down on his leg. And then when he hit it, like, it stopped. And so his leg was sort of being crushed. But anytime anyone tried to lift it, which was everyone's first, impulse, like a ton of steel, they would restart the stop mechanism. So he was trapped there for a long time until they could shut the whole thing down and get it, lifted. So what happened was, as far as I understand, is some of the muscle tissue in his leg, because of lack of oxygen, I think it died or atrophied. And so they had to take some muscle from his bum and replace it. But then, like 7 months in, he was back in the show. He was an amazing young guy. He just was like, nope, I'm gonna do it. And he was back in on power skips, doing flips, and he was a young guy. And
Was that in London?
that was in London. So we'd already run the show for like 7 months in Toronto, and had never been we'd been working on the show for a year and a half in Toronto, and it had never been an issue. So it was a surprise when that had happened. They thought all the bugs had been discovered. So, but that was the only, injury, just a weird happenstance.
The performance of Gollum, then, how did you approach it as an actor? Because did you take reference from animals? Did you take reference from slime molds? How did you do it?
Yeah, my version of this question was, how did you not totally screw up your body and voice?
Well, so I'll answer that in two parts. So, I originally auditioned for a bunch of hobbits. I auditioned for Frodo, and I remember when I was walking into the audition room, I saw the monologue for Gollum, and I was like, "Oh, that looks great." And I remember going in for Frodo, and I said, "Hey, can I just try this?" And they said, "Sure." And I did the bad Andy Serkis impersonation for about 2 seconds, which just basically sounded like Yoda. It was like, and I went, oh God, forget about it. No, that's embarrassing. Let's forget you heard that. Let's do Frodo." And then they brought me back for Sam and a bunch of like the same day. And then I was only actually in Toronto. I was doing a show on Broadway. I was doing Fiddler on the Roof, and they knew they only had me for the day. So I flew in for the audition. So I was very fortunate that they were trying me in a lot of things because they knew I couldn't come back. So at the end of the day, everyone went home. They said, "Mike, can you stay back? And we're going to try Gollum again." And it was just me and the creative team and the casting in a room. And they were just said, "Look, we don't know what we want it to be. We know we don't want the film, but we don't know what it should be." So the choreographer, Peter Darling, said, "Can you do me a favor? Describe Gollum, put him into one sentence." And so I had a couple different things I said, but like he's a drug addict who desperately needs his fix, or he's like someone who's being repressed, who hates his repressors, but also desperately needs them, so they said, "Can you go away for 50 minutes, come back and physicalize that three different ways?" So I just sort of did something, and I'd show them three different ideas of what that meant to me physically. And they said, "Now do the monologue." And it just connected. I wasn't doing a voice, but everything felt connected. And I remember thinking, "Oh my God, that's a totally different thing." And the next day I got
Lovely.
the part. And it was very quick. So then when I got it, I knew the voice was not the way in. So I've done this before in shows where you go to like dance magazines and get images of that speak to you. Like, "I like that body shape, I like what that says." And so I'd lay them on the floor and then just go, "I think that's maybe for that moment, and that's for that moment," and trying to create pictures that say something emotionally. And then but then, I had like a notebook of all these things. I just kept trying different ideas. What if his spine worked this way? What if he does this way? And the thing that eventually was the hook is Peter Darling had said, in the books, he's always obsessed with the beginnings of things. He's looking under the roots of trees and on the ground, and he's under rocks. And he says, "What if all the all that time they spend doing that, these muscles have died or have atrophied, so that it takes a lot of effort to hold his head up. So that became, it's like to stand, it's
Nice.
like to move yourself through space is to, you find a way with your body to throw your head forward and the rest of the body would follow. If you need
Yeah.
to, the body has to, you have to throw the body in the air and the rest of the body would line up until it falls over again. So that's sort of how was the hook
Lovely.
for Smeagol. And then Gollum was the antithesis of that, was the guy who went, fuck that, and pushed his way out and had some strength for a second until Smeagol melted. So that's how it became a very physical entity. And then the voice just happened, which was just a lot of screaming, really. The other thing is, the other thing is, they were really generous that they're like, what do you think he should look like? Do you think he needs teeth? Do you think he needs feet? And I heard that
Giant teeth.
conversation. And I did have teeth, which affected the way I sounded. They were like shark teeth almost, and they were plastic and silver, and they went over my teeth. And but they've completely changed my jaw position and
Yeah.
how much effort it took to be articulate. And then they left me a room with Leslie Olson, who was the makeup artist, with a bunch of goo, and we started slapping stuff to my body and painting it. And what about this? What about this? And they came in and check. Oh yeah. And
What a
because.
lovely process. That's
It
wonderful.
was, yeah. And Rob, who designed it, he had Rob Howell, he had a bunch of images as references too. Like he had really cool, like skin sort of being pulled back and knotted, like not real skin. It was like made out of a
Yeah.
cloth. And so we used like cheesecloth and we glued that to my whole body. And it was
Oh,
the
yeah.
cloth was stitched with black thread, and then it was sort of like it was everything was being tied and knotted into like pieces of
Wow.
me. And when I got to London, because that took a couple hours to do every day, and in
Oof.
Toronto on a two-show day, I couldn't get out of it. So by the end of, at that point, the show was like 4.5 hours long. So by the time
Oh, God.
the end of the sh day of a two-show day, I had so many layers of paint and so much glue. That when we got to London, I said, can we just make this a bodysuit? Because people would come up to me and go, love that bodysuit. And they're like, it's me. It's not a bodysuit, that's me. The bodysuit afforded us to create depth where ribs were painted on in Toronto
Top of the
because
body, yeah.
we could actually put a bit of foam. It actually gave me a little more hollowed out look. So there's advantages and disadvantages of both. There was a shine to a bodysuit that you don't have with skin, but it was a hell of a lot faster and easier. Yeah.
A 9 hour
And
day doing that, I think I'd be rather be in a suit
yeah.
than, yeah.
Yeah.
Oof.
How did you protect yourself physically from all that? Did it affect you physically?
Well, I did go to physio a lot and get massage and in London, it actually bothered my voice more. I got sort of attached to screaming sounds, and I think I was doing something compressing with my vocal cords that became habitual. Because I remember there was a place where my voice was in Toronto. My voice was spasming, like, and where I would like I couldn't breathe in, I couldn't breathe out. Like this is not in rehearsals. At like, and I was like, and I'd go to emergency and be like, oh, and they're like, oh yeah, I remember them saying, this is really cool. The Pope has this. It's called spasmodic dysphonia. Don't worry, you'll never ever die. You'll just faint, and then you'll start breathing again. I'm like, I do a show. I can't just faint on stage. But it eventually worked itself out. But
God, that's stressful.
so I think my body actually was pretty fine, and my voice, after doing it for so long, I needed to get more sort of guidance to unlearn those habits,
I guess, yeah, that's exactly it. It's built into the body after that length of time, yeah.
I guess the second part of that is how you protect yourself emotionally. I'm thinking of roles like Leo Frank. How long are you in parade for? It was a couple of months, eh?
Well, no, it was a I think it was probably a 10-week contract.
Oh.
Or those here in Toronto are, there was just a regional show, so it wasn't a long, it might even been 8 weeks. Like we might have had like 5 week run, 3 week rehearsal. I can't remember. But
Such a good show.
there's something, yeah, it's a great show. And I saw the production That they did at Donmar, I think.
Yeah, it was the Donmar warehouse. Bertie Carvel was Leo Frank in that one. It was superb.
It was superb. So Brent Carver, who originated it, I actually have a cool story about Parade because I have a long relationship with it. Because when I got out of school, I'll try to make this like Reader's Digest version, but when I got out of school, a producer at Live Ant happened to see me in a show, and he was kind of champion of mine, I guess, and he very very kind. And I interned at Live Ant for a while. And anyway, I was working in a coffee shop, like going, my life is never going to happen. Like, and I went to check my message from a payphone, and my agent said, "Hal Prince wants to see you in New York, and for this new show called Parade. They're doing a workshop, and they want to fly you down. Like, do you want to go?" And I was like, "What? Hal Prince? What?" And it was because this gentleman, Marty Bell, had sort of said, "I know this young guy who looks really young in Toronto, and I think he'd be good." So I didn't get it, but it was like life changing. I flew down to New York, and I was like, that was my first time in New York. And I remember like going into the waiting room, and all the people I'd just seen on the Tony Awards were there, and I was like, I can't believe this is happening. And go in the room, and there's like, Hal Prince, like Garth Jabinski, Jason Robert Brown, and it was so stupid because I only had one song in my book, and it was like "The Kite" from "You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown," which is not even appropriate. Like, remember when I started, Marty, like I was really nervous, and Marty went, "Knock 'em dead, kid." And I did the thing, and they're like, and Jason's like, "Does he have a pop song? Does he have a rock song?" And I didn't have anything. And they're like, "Oh," and so it ended there because what I brought was so inappropriate. Anyway, all that to say, years later, I was at the Stratford Festival, took two shows to New York, Much Ado About Nothing and The Miser. And so we went with that. And we were invited to the dress rehearsal of Parade, starring Brent Carver, who's a Canadian who I eventually worked with. And it was amazing. And I remember watching Brent just thinking, like, oh my God, especially in It's Hard to Speak My Heart. It just felt like a close up. Like he just, the whole theater went shh. And I was like in a back row, and it felt like I was seeing everything. He was amazing. So when it came up years later for me to do it, I mean, I was just like, yes. And when you talk about protecting your emotions, funny enough, I think, when you're doing that stuff, you do on stage, you find something to go through, and it's somehow cathartic. And the show's over, and you close the book on that. Like, it doesn't feel. When I was younger, I made the mistake of thinking I had to live in that emotional place forever. So I
Oh
did
God.
The Seagull. I was terrible, Constantine, I was terrible. I didn't know what I was doing, and I was just like wrecking myself and like, ugh. And I didn't succeed with the show, and it was not fun to do because I was in a horrible place, and I learned as I got older that you don't need to do that, like. It's a, you're spending all your pennies before you step on stage, just go on stage and be where, it'll happen in the right time if you have invested into it. And then when the show's done, you've had a nice cathartic moment, and you close that, and you go back to your life, and you can let it go.
Do you remember the old tale of Laurence Olivier to Dustin Hoffman? Why don't you try acting, dear boy?
Yeah, I love those stories. I did have something else to say. Oh, yeah, a really amazing actor who's since passed, Peter Donaldson. When we were doing The Seagull, I remember watching him in rehearsals, and I just felt like he got it. And I sort of knocked on the door. I said, "Hey, Pete," like he sort of intimidated because I thought he was fantastic. But I said, "I'm a little lost." He says, "Meet me on the roof, after rehearsal or whatever, after the
Oh,
pre."
shoot, some seagulls.
Yeah, no, we'll talk. Like, I just think, so that no one's listening, like, and he said, Mike, I think what's happening is you're at the end of every scene, you're having a big explosion, like, why you don't love me, or how did you do this? He says, so basically, if you're a pot that's like on the stove, it's releasing every scene. So you got to go back and start simmering again. He said, what's more painful, like, what the reason someone tries to commit suicide is because they don't have that release. So you might be better served to just, instead of allowing yourself to explode, just say, I'm really upset with you. And I, 'cause you don't know what to do with it. And that, and then by the end of the play, you, the only way to deal with that emotion is, and I was like, oh, that makes so much sense. But it was too late for me to inst, and I didn't, too young, and I didn't know how to inst in put that at that point, but I've never forgotten it because it makes a lot of sense.
You were talking about other actors there. Alistair's not gonna let me say actors' names and then make you talk about them, but can I do just one? William Hutt.
Yeah, he was amazing.
Wow.
I was really lucky because I spent a lot of time with Bill. So most people call him Bill who know him or called him Bill. But he, yeah, he was amazing. He, one thing, he had a little gems, like, you know, we say about the, like, Peter Brook or different, Olivier, those kind of gems. And one of the things he said was, never move unless it improves on stillness, and never speak unless it improves on silence, which I love. Or I'd say, like, you know, when you give focus to another actor on stage, but you, when you put a light on them by giving them focus, you shed an equally bright light on yourself. You know, little things like that. But I got to spend a lot of time with him, and in a couple of plays, and he was a really incredible, incredible actor and an incredible guy. Yeah, I feel very lucky that I.
Right. And you were his Ariel.
Yeah, and then he directed.
Oh, I love Ariel. Gosh.
Yeah, and watching him realize he did something amazing. He had the moment where I say, where Ariel says, where he, sorry, Prospero says, would you forgive them? And Ariel says, I would, were I human. And Bill would take this huge pause, like he'd sort of, like it was just mind-blowing, that the realization. And then he would look at his hands, and then it, like, just, he would take like a full minute, maybe two, to like let that, it was just silent, and then the play would keep going. It, for him, that was the most
Wow.
important part, and it was every night. It was just mesmerizing to watch, and you couldn't hear anything. People were just on the edge of their seat watching this idea drop.
I think that's one of the key things I learned about acting in the years I haven't been doing it, because I haven't been on stage for a wee while. I've stepped away out from productions that didn't have hearts in them, so I need to, it needs to have a real reason for me to be in it, I found. But the core thing of acting is not acting, it's listening.
Yeah.
And that is what the skill is, to listen and then react to what you're listening to. Not, and that always takes you beyond the moment and into the present, that constant evolving present, which is just amazing.
Yeah.
One thing I'd, one name I'd like to ask about, if that's okay, is
Yeah.
Bob
Help me, I wasn't
Ho
allowed to listen. Names.
well, Bob Hoskins, because his background was with Ken Campbell, who was a kind of theatre anarchist here in the UK, who just is, to me, is the apex of wonderful. But how
Yeah,
was Bob Hoskins to work with?
he was really a sweet guy, really nice. I had a funny exchange with him at the party at the end of shooting, The Englishman's Boy, and he said, "Can I tell you something?" I said, "Sure, yeah, sure." He says, "You know, when it's the other person's take," he said, "don't look so intently. Like, just wait for action and then go." Because I was trying to be a great listener, so, you know, like, they'd be get, like, and camera, and I'd be like, just like, I'm ready to hear everything you have to say. And I think he found that a bit off-putting, you know. He's like, no, just wait till action, and then engage.
Horror.
Sure.
Can we talk about horror? You've become a sort of horror guy.
Yeah, I know, it's weird.
You've been killed in various horrendous ways. 3 times by Chucky. Oh, I spoke to one of my young staff is a huge horror fan, and he said, and I asked him what his favorite Chucky death was, and he said, oh, it's when that guy gets his head smashed in with a shoe. And I was like, oh, I'm talking to him later, and he said, tell him he's class.
Oh,
So
thanks,
you
thanks.
are class. He
Well,
was
that's
well
nice.
impressed. He was well impressed.
He's
So
glad you
have you?
survived.
Yeah, I think he's talking about you, the actor, rather than your character, who is horrendous. How have you become a horror
I don't know. It's very strange.
guy?
Fun. It's fun. It's funny. Every time I get a job, my mom always goes, "Do you die again?" I was like, "Yes, mom, I die. I always die." But Yeah, it's been, I don't know how that happened. But it's a lot of fun. And
Yeah.
when I got that movie, the Chucky movie, I remember Don Mancini calling me at home, which is, no one has ever done that. When you get like a
Yeah.
director never called me at home, and he's like, I just want to welcome you to the team. Or and I was like, I said, I this had never ever happened in my life. And I said, I'm just kind of blown away. And he said, well, you'll find that people in horror are really nice, and they really are. And that was one of the funnest sets to be on, because it's just like a bunch of, like, everyone's so happy, because Don actually is such, is like one of the nicest people you will ever meet. Like he's so respectful of everybody. He's always smiling. He's super positive. He loves Chucky. He's really passionate about it. But it's a really fun. He sets a great tone of set, and crews are so happy. They love him. So it's just a great place. But when and him watching the monitor, he just like sometimes looks like a bit of a, like a kid who just loves. He just loves.
That's
Loves their
wonderful.
job, yeah, everyone on that show, the puppeteers, everyone is incredible. It sounds, it's funny to, I keep saying that, oh, they're fantastic, they're so nice, and it sounds pat, but I mean it wholeheartedly. I've been very lucky to work with some really nice people. Because when you work with people who aren't, it's not nice, it's not fun.
It's yeah.
Alistair and I, we've been talking quite a lot recently about how horror is a very resilient genre for cinemas, because it's one of the two, comedy and horror, where you need an audience in order to experience it fully. And another one of your horror films, Here for Blood, is the sort of epitome of that kind of film that you need an audience for, that schlocky. I've been trying to think of another word for schlocky because I don't want it to have negative connotations, which I don't mean it negatively at all, but it's that kind of really good fun, silly, audience pleasing horror film to
And
watch.
that's the other, like, that's the other side of the spectrum, because Here for Blood was a father and son who wrote a script and really wanted to make a movie. And so, everyone was just sort of doing it for next to nothing. And they rented a house on Airbnb and shot in there. And like, it was very
What was the
very
cleaning
low
bill?
budget, really fast. Yeah, very indie, I was thinking about that house. There was so much blood. I thought, oh my God, how are they ever going to get the blood in this house? But that was a lot of fun. I do have a funny Chucky story, which you might have heard, because I've said this before. But just before the head smashing, there was a scene where I have Nika, and I've sedated her, and I'm going to abuse her. But I pull out of my desk these shoes that she eventually stomps my head with, and seductively and kind of creepily, I'm trying to put them on her feet, and she's upset and crying, but she's paralyzed, so she can't stop me. Well, when we were shooting that, my close up on that, I'm trying to be creepy, and I'm putting them on, and it's just not happening. And I just keep struggling. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna make this work. I'm gonna make this work. And I'm like, it's just not happening. But I wasn't gonna drop it. And eventually, Fiona goes, it's on the wrong foot. So I've been trying
Oh,
to,
lovely.
so we both burst out laughing, and I couldn't believe I, because they just let it go. Because Don said, we were just wondering, what are they gonna do? How's he gonna deal with that? And so we just let the camera keep running.
That's nice.
That's brilliant.
Okay. Yeah, there's. Well, I was going to say that obviously we're conscious of your time going on.
Yes.
In our list of questions, that we kind of have one or two at the end, which is, of the career that you've done so much, what is there left to do? What are you wanting to do next? Are there any challenges that you think you'd really like to take on?
Oh yeah, like I can't think of a particular show. I just want to keep working. I feel like every time I get a job, it's this giant challenge. Like, because every time you get some, you're like, will I fail on this? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just want to keep doing things that are challenging. I love the change of going, doing a musical, then doing a play, then doing a classic, then doing a modern. Then, like, I love using all those tools, and I hope I continue to get to. Doing a musical again with Charlie was so Charlie and the Chocolate Factory was so much fun because I hadn't done one in a long time, and I'm going back to Shaw to do one again. And I love being physical. I thankfully my body's still fine, and I would love to keep. I like being creative that way. Yeah, I just want going. I don't want to retire. I get that's the one thing about doing TV, I should say. Well, about like in Canada, it feels like you have to sort of make a decision for a couple of years. I'm gonna do TV for a couple of years, or film and TV, and then I'm gonna do theater for a couple of years, and then because they don't always work hand in hand casting
Right.
wise. And as well, I love working in film TV when I'm working, but the sitting at home waiting, I realize I would never want to be retired because this feels like retirement and I don't like it. I like to
Yeah.
work,
Would you want to direct? Or have you directed?
I haven't directed. I think I'd really like to, like in a small setting, like in a school or something. I think that lately I've been teaching a little bit at a college around the corner for me, like
Nice.
just classes here and there, and I like sort of coaching kids. So they'll get up and do something. I'll go, "Have you thought about this way? Why is it doing that?" Blah, blah. And I love it. I love it. And it's sort of like saying, "Let's jam together. Let's try." Like, because that's how I kind of like to work. I don't usually have a really clear idea what I want to do. I feel like you probably feel the same way. You throw darts at a dartboard and slowly you zero in on what it is. And then you find a
Yeah.
hook. And there you go. That gels all those ideas together is when you find the hook. Or I'd say, like, it's like, I'm going to try this coat on. Try this coat on. Try this coat on. Like character ideas or how to play something. So it's really fun to jam with people and get really excited about what you're seeing and work together on creating something more than, "Hi, I'm the director and this is what you're doing." And it's good to come in with that plan, I think, as a director, but I do love jamming. So the answer is yes, I would love to, but in a safe way, in a place where the stress is not high. Yeah.
Great, thank you so much to Michael Terrio for joining us. He was so sweet. I basically messaged him out of the
Fantastic.
blue and said, "Would you do this?" And he said yes, which is very. It was just a little bit baffling, but also very, very sweet of him. And he sat with us for
So kind.
about an hour, didn't he? And
Yeah.
showed us his dog, crucially.
Oh, lovely dog. Yeah. And also a one-eyed dog as well, like
A
your own
one,
dog.
yeah, one-eyed dog. So I got a bit. I think I was weirdly excited when he said that his dog had one eye. I sort of did a reaction that I don't think people would be used to. I was like, "Yes! Oh my God, a one-eyed dog!" And then I had to explain this because I also had a one-eyed dog, and a three-legged dog, and I hope I wasn't too weird.
It's fine. I think the restraining order will be with us fairly soon, but otherwise everything's grand.
Do you know what? I realized I was listening back to the recording and I'd said at the beginning, "Oh, I'm a really big fan." And then I thought, is that weird to say to somebody? But it's not weird
No, not at all. That's lovely.
unless you then follow it up as I did with, but not in a weird, creepy way.
No, that's fine.
was...
As opposed to the couple that I met who listened to my other podcast, who went, "I moved here because of you."
Oh, really?
That was strange.
That is a bit.
And then there was someone else who sent pictures of themselves. And I don't want to talk more about that, but that was
What?
very strange. I'm not going to talk about that. That is a bit scary.
Okay, we're gonna go now, and I'm gonna get Alistair to talk to me about the p people who sent him pictures.
I don't want to talk about it.
Thank you again, Michael Terrio. We'll be back in about a week with more nonsense with the sex XX episode, which I don't seem to be able to talk Alistair out of doing. So that'll be us.
I look forward to hearing things in from the audience. That'll be fab.
Down the back of the seats at gmail.com or on the various socials media, apart from X, obviously, down the back of the seats.
Thanks for listening. See you again soon.